But Doremus Jessup could not plan. I'll have Sissy go to Smith before she studies architecture. Or, if Julian Falk and Sissy get married and stick here in the fort, I'll give 'em the southwest lot, and some day, maybe 15 years from now, the whole place will be filled with nice kids again. No, 15 years from now, he sighed, Sissy might be hustling hash for the sort of workers who called the waiter's art hustling hash. And Julian might be in a concentration camp, fascist or communist. The Horatio Alger tradition, from rags to Rockefellers, was clean gone out of the America it had dominated. It seemed faintly silly to hope, to try to prophesy, to give up sleep on a good mattress for toil on a typewriter, and as for saving money, idiotic. And for a newspaper editor, for one who must know, at least as well as the encyclopedia, everything about local and foreign history, geography, economics, politics, literature, and methods of playing football, it was maddening that it seemed impossible now to know anything, surely. "He don't know what it's all about," had in a year or two changed from a colloquial sneer to a sound general statement regarding almost any economist. Once, modestly enough, Doremus had assumed that he had a decent knowledge of finance, taxation, the gold standard, agricultural exports, and he had smilingly pontificated everywhere that liberal capitalism would pastorally lead into state socialism, with governmental ownership of mines and railroads and water power, so settling all inequalities of income, that every lion of a structural steel worker would be willing to lie down with any lamb of a contractor, and all the jails and tuberculosis sanatoria would be clean empty. Now he knew that he knew nothing fundamental, and like a lone monk stricken with a conviction of sin, he mourned, "If only I knew more! Yes, and if I could only remember statistics." The coming and the going of the NRA, the FERA, the PWA, and all the rest had convinced Doremus that there were four sets of people who did not clearly understand anything whatever about how the government must be conducted. All the authorities in Washington, all of the citizenry who talked or wrote profusely about politics, the bewildered untouchables who said nothing, and Doremus Jessup. "But," said he, "now, after Buzz's inauguration, everything is going to be completely simple and comprehensible again. The country is going to be run as his private domain." Julian Falk, now sophomore in Amherst, had come home for Christmas vacation, and he dropped in at the Informer office to beg from Doremus a ride home before dinner. He called Doremus sir and did not seem to think he was a comic fossil. Doremus liked it. On the way they stopped for gasoline at the garage of John Polycop, the seething social democrat, and were waited upon by Carl Paschal, sometime donkey engine man at Tasbro's quarry, sometime strike leader, sometime political prisoner in the county jail on a thin charge of inciting to riot, and ever since then, a model of communistic piety. Paschal was a thin man, but sinewy. His gaunt and humorous face of a good mechanic was so grease-darkened that the skin above and below his eyes seemed white as a fish belly, and in turn, that pallid rim made his eyes, alert dark gypsy eyes, seem the larger, a panther chained to a coal cart. "Well, what are you going to do after this election?" said Doremus. "Oh, that's a fool question. I guess none of us chronic kickers want to say much about what we plan to do after January when Buzz gets his hands on us. Lie low, eh?" "I'm going to lie the lowest lie that I ever did. You bet. But maybe there'll be a few communist cells around here now when fascism begins to get into people's hair. Never did have much success with my propaganda before, but now you watch," exulted Paschal. "You don't seem so depressed by the election," marveled Doremus, while Julian offered, "No, you seem quite cheerful about it." "Depressed? My good lord, Mr. Jessup, I thought you knew your revolutionary tactics better than that, where you supported us in the quarry strike. even if you are the perfect type of small capitalist bourgeois. Depressed? Why, can't you see? If the communists had paid for it, they couldn't have had anything more elegant for our purposes than the election of a pro-plutocrat, itching, militarist dictator like Buzz Windrip. Look, he'll get everybody plenty dissatisfied. But they can't do anything barehanded against the armed troops. Then he'll whoop it up for a war, and so millions of people will have arms and food rations in their hands, all ready for the revolution. Hooray for Buzz and John Prang the Baptist. Carl, it's funny about you. I honestly believe you believe in communism, marveled young Julian. Don't you? Why don't you go and ask your friend Father Parafix if he believes in the Virgin? But you seem to like America, and you don't seem so fanatical, Carl. I remember when I was a kid of about 10, and you, well, I suppose you were about 25 or 26 then, you used to slide with us and whoop like hell, and you made me a ski stick. Sure I like America. Came here when I was 2 years old. I was born in Germany. My folks weren't Heinies, though. My dad was French and my mother a hunky from Serbia. Guess that makes me 100% American, all right. I think we've got the old country beat lots of ways. Why, say, Julian, over there I'd have to call you Mein Herr or Your Excellency or some fool thing. And you'd call me, I say it, Pascal. Mr. Jessup here, my lord, he'd be Commendatore or Herr Doctor. No, I like it here. There's symptoms of possible future democracy. But, what burns me up? It isn't that old soapboxer's chestnut about how 0.1% of the population at the top have an aggregate income equal to 42% at the bottom. Figures like that are too astronomical. Don't mean a thing in the world to a fellow with his eyes and nose down in a transmission box. Fellow that doesn't see the stars except after 9 p.m. on odd Wednesdays. But what burns me up is the fact that even before this depression, in what you folks called prosperous times, 7% of all the families in the country earned $500 a year or less. Remember, those weren't the unemployed on relief. Those were the guys that had the honor of still doing honest labor. $500 a year is $10 a week, and that means one dirty little room for a family of 4 people. It means $5 a week for all their food, 18 cents per day per person for food, and even the lousiest prisons allow more than that. And the magnificent remainder of $2.50 a week, that means 9 cents per day per person for clothes, insurance, car fares, doctor's bills, dentist's bills, and for God's sake, amusements. Amusements! And all the rest of the 9 cents a day they can fritter away on their Fords and auto gyros and, when they feel fagged, skipping across the pond on the Normandy. 7% of all the fortunate American families where the old man has got a job. Julian was silent, then whispered, "You know, fellow gets discussing economics in college, theoretically sympathetic, but to see your own kids living on 18 cents a day for grub, I guess that would make a man pretty extremist." Doremus fretted, "But what percentage of forced labor in your Russian lumber camps and Siberian prison mines are getting more than that?" "Ah, that's all baloney. That's the old standard comeback at every communist. Just like once, 20 years ago, the muttonheads used to think they'd crushed any socialist when they snickered, 'If all the money was divided up, inside 5 years, the hustlers would have all of it again.' Probably there's some standard coup de grace like that in Russia to crush anybody that defends America. Besides," Carl Paschal glowed with nationalistic fervor, "we Americans aren't like those dumb Ruski peasants. We'll do a whole lot better when we get communism." And on that, his employer, the expansive John Polycop, a woolly Scotch terrier of a man, returned to the garage. John was an excellent friend of Doremus, had indeed been his bootlegger all through Prohibition, personally running in his whiskey from Canada. He had been known, even in that singularly scrupulous profession, as one of its most trustworthy practitioners. Now he flowered into mid-European dialectics. "Evening, Miss Jessop. Evening, Julian. Carl fill up your tank for you? You want to watch that guy? He's likely to hold out a gallon on you. He's one of these crazy dogs of communists. They all believe in violence instead of evolution and legality. Them, why, say, if they hadn't been so crooked, if they joined me and Norman Thomas and the other intelligent socialists in the United Front with Roosevelt and the Jeffersonians, I say, we'd have licked the pants off Buzzard Windrip. Windrip and his plans." Buzzard Windrip. That was good, Doremus reflected. He'd be able to use it in the Informer. Pascal protested, "Not that Buzzard's personal plans and ambitions have got much to do with it. Altogether too easy to explain everything, just blaming it on Windrip. Why don't you read your Marx, John, instead of always gassing about him? Why, Windrip's just something nasty that's been vomited up. Plenty others still left fermenting in the stomach. Quack economists with every sort of economic ptomaine. No, Buzz isn't important. It's the sickness that made us throw him up that we've got to attend to. The sickness of more than 30% permanently unemployed and growing larger. Got to cure it." "Can you crazy tovarishes cure it?" snapped Polycarp. "And do you think communism will cure it?" skeptically wondered Doremus. And more politely, "Do you really think Karl Marx had the dope?" worried Julian, all three at once. "You bet your life we can," said Pascal vaingloriously. As Doremus, driving away, looked back at them, Pascal and Polycarp were removing a flat tire together and quarreling bitterly, quite happily. Doremus's attic study had been to him a refuge from the tender solicitudes of Emma and Mrs. Candy and his daughters, and all the impulsive handshaking strangers who wanted the local editor to start off their campaigns for the sale of life insurance or gas-saving carburetors, for the Salvation Army or the Red Cross or the Orphan's Home or the Anti-Cancer Crusade, or the assorted magazines which would enable to go through college young men who at all cost should be kept out of college. It was a refuge now from the considerably less tender solicitudes of supporters of the president-elect. On the pretense of work, Doremus took to sneaking up there in mid-evening, and he sat not in an easy chair, but stiffly, at his desk, making crosses and five-pointed stars and six-pointed stars and fancy delete signs on sheets of yellow copy paper, while he sorely meditated. Thus, this evening, after the demands of Karl Pascal and John Polycarp, the revolt against civilization. But there's the worst trouble of this whole cursed business of analysis. When I get to defending democracy against communism and fascism and whatnot, I sound just like the Lothrop Stoddards. Why, I sound almost like a Hearst editorial on how some college has got to kick out a dangerous red instructor in order to preserve our democracy for the ideals of Jefferson and Washington. Yet somehow singing the same words, I have a notion my tune is entirely different from Hearst's. I don't think we've done very well with all the plowland and forest and minerals and husky human stock we've had. What makes me sick about Hearst and the D.A.R. is that if they are against communism, I have to be for it, and I don't want to be. Wastage of resources, so they're about gone. That's been the American share in the revolt against civilization. We can go back to the Dark Ages. The crust of learning and good manners and tolerance is so thin. It would just take a few thousand big shells and gas bombs to wipe out all the eager young men, and all the libraries and historical archives and patent offices, all the laboratories and art galleries, all the castles and Periclean temples and Gothic cathedrals, all the cooperative stores and motor factories, every storehouse of learning. No inherent reason why Sissy's grandchildren, if anybody's grandchildren will survive at all, shouldn't be living in caves and heaving rocks at catamounts. And what's the solution of preventing this debacle? Plenty of 'em. The communists have a patent solution they know will work. So have the fascists and the rigid American constitutionalists who call themselves advocates of democracy without any notion what the word ought to mean, and the monarchists who are certain that if we could just resurrect the Kaiser and the Tsar and King Alfonso, everybody would be loyal and happy again, and the banks would simply force credit on small businessmen at 2%. And all the preachers, they tell you that they alone have the inspired solution. Well, gentlemen, I have listened to all your solutions, and I now inform you that I, and I alone, except perhaps for Walt Trowbridge and the ghost of Pareto, have the perfect, the inevitable, the only solution. And that is, there is no solution. There will never be a state of society anything like perfect. There never will be a time when there won't be a large proportion of people who feel poor no matter how much they have, and envy their neighbors who know how to wear cheap clothes showily, and envy neighbors who can dance or make love or digest better. Doremus suspected that with the most scientific state it would be impossible for iron deposits always to find themselves at exactly the rate decided upon 2 years before by the National Technocratic Minerals Commission, no matter how elevated and fraternal and utopian the principles of the commissioners. His solution, Doremus pointed out, was the only one that did not flee before the thought that 1,000 years from now human beings would probably continue to die of cancer and earthquake and such clownish mishaps as slipping in bathtubs. It presumed that mankind would continue to be burdened with eyes that grow weak, feet that grow tired, noses that itch, intestines vulnerable to bacilli, and generative organs that are nervous until the age of virtue and senility. It seemed to him unidealistically probable, for all the contemporary furniture of the 1930s, that most people would continue, at least for a few hundred years, to sit in chairs, eat from dishes upon tables, read books, no matter how many cunning phonographic substitutes might be invented, wear shoes or sandals, sleep in beds, write with some sort of pens, and in general spend 20 or 22 hours a day much as they had spent them in 1930, in 1630. He suspected that tornadoes, floods, droughts, lightning, and mosquitoes would remain, along with the homicidal tendency known in the best of citizens when their sweethearts go dancing off with other men. And most fatally and abysmally, his solution guessed that men of superior cunning, of slyer foxiness, whether they might be called comrades, brethren, commissars, kings, patriots, little brothers of the poor, or any other rosy name, would continue to have more influence than slower-witted men, however worthy. All the warring solutions, except his, Doremus chuckled, were ferociously propagated by the fanatics, the nuts. He recalled an article in which Neil Carruthers asserted that the rabble-rousers of America in the mid-30s had a long and dishonorable ancestry of prophets who had felt called upon to stir up the masses to save the world, and save it in the prophet's own way, and do it right now and most violently. Peter the Hermit, the ragged, mad, and stinking monk who, to rescue the unidentified tomb of the Savior from undefined outrages by the pagans, led out on the Crusades some hundreds of thousands of European peasants to die on the way of starvation after burning, raping, and murdering fellow peasants in foreign villages all along the road. There was John Ball, who, in 1381, was a share-the-wealth advocate. He preached equality of wealth, the abolition of class distinctions, and what would now be called communism, and whose follower, Wat Tyler, looted London, with the final gratifying result that afterward labor was by the frightened government more oppressed than ever. And nearly 300 years later, Cromwell's methods of expounding the sweet winsomeness of purity and liberty were shooting, slashing, clubbing, starving, and burning people. And after him, the workers paid for the spree of bloody righteousness with blood. Brooding about it, fishing in the muddy slough of recollection which most Americans have in place of a clear pool of history, Doremus was able to add other names of well-meaning rabble-rousers. Murat and Danton and Robespierre, who helped shift the control of France from the moldy aristocrats to the stuffy, centime-pinching shopkeepers. Lenin and Trotsky, who gave to the illiterate Russian peasants the privileges of punching a time clock, and of being as learned, gay, and dignified as the factory hands in Detroit. And Lenin's man, Borodin, who extended this boon to China. And that William Randolph Hearst, who in 1898 was the Lenin of Cuba and switched the mastery of the Golden Isle from the cruel Spaniards to the peaceful, unarmed, brotherly, loving Cuban politicians of today. The American Moses, Dowie, and his theocracy at Zion City, Illinois, where the only results of the direct leadership of God, as directed and encouraged by Mr. Dowie and by his even more spirited successor, Mr. Bolivar, were that the holy denizens were deprived of oysters and cigarettes and cursing, and died without the aid of doctors instead of with it, and that the stretch of road through Zion City incessantly caused the breakage of springs on the cars of citizens from Evanston, Wilmette, and Winnetka, which may or may not have been a desirable good deed. Cecil Rhodes, his vision of making South Africa a British paradise, and the actuality of making it a graveyard for British soldiers. All the utopias, Brook Farm, Robert Owen's Sanctuary of Chatter, Upton Sinclair's Helicon Hall, and their regulation end in scandal, feuds, poverty, grimness, disillusion. All the leaders of Prohibition, so certain that their cause was world-regenerating, that for it they were willing to shoot down violators. It seemed to Doremus that the only rabble-rouser to build permanently had been Brigham Young, with his bearded Mormon captains, who not only turned the Utah desert into an Eden, but made it pay, and kept it up. Pondered Doremus, blessed be they who are not patriots and idealists, and who do not feel they must dash right in and do something about it. Something so immediately important that all doubters must be liquidated, tortured, slaughtered. Good old murder, that since the slaying of Abel by Cain has always been the new device by which all oligarchies and dictators have, for all future ages to come, removed opposition. In this acid mood, Doremus doubted the efficacy of all revolutions, dared even a little to doubt our two American revolutions, against England in 1776, and the Civil War. For a New England editor to contemplate even the smallest criticism of these wars was what it would have been for a Southern Baptist fundamentalist preacher to question immortality, the inspiration of the Bible, and the ethical value of shouting hallelujah. Yet had it, Doremus queried nervously, been necessary to have 4 years of inconceivably murderous civil war, followed by 20 years of commercial oppression of the South in order to preserve the Union, free the slaves, and establish the equality of industry with agriculture? Had it been just to the Negroes themselves to throw them so suddenly, with so little preparation, into full citizenship, that the Southern states, in what they considered self-defense, disqualified them at the polls and lynched them and lashed them? Could they not, as Lincoln at first desired and planned, have been freed without the vote, then gradually and competently educated under federal guardianship, so that by 1890 they might, without too much enmity, have been able to enter fully into all the activities of the land? A generation and a half, Doremus meditated, of the sturdiest and most gallant killed or crippled in the Civil War, or perhaps worst of all, becoming garrulous professional heroes and satellites of the politicians, who in return for their solid vote made all lazy jobs save for the GAR. The most valorous, it was they who suffered the most, for while the John D. Rockefellers, the J.P. Morgans, the Vanderbilts, Astors, Goulds, and all their nimble financial comrades of the South did not enlist but stayed in the warm, dry counting house, drawing the fortune of the country into their webs, it was Jeb Stuart, Stonewall Jackson, Nathaniel Lyon, Pat Claiborne, and the knightly James B. McPherson, who were killed, and with them Abraham Lincoln. So, with the hundreds of thousands who should have been the progenitors of new American generations drained away, we could show the world which from 1780 to 1860 had so admired men like Franklin, Jefferson, Washington, Hamilton, the Adamses, Webster, only such salvages as McKinley, Benjamin Harrison, William Jennings Bryan, Harding, and Senator Berzelius Windrip and his rivals. Slavery had been a cancer, and in that day was known no remedy save bloody cutting. There had been no x-rays of wisdom and tolerance. Yet to sentimentalize this cutting, to justify and rejoice in it, was an altogether evil thing, a national superstition that was later to lead to other unavoidable wars. Wars to free Cubans, to free Filipinos who didn't want our brand of freedom, to end all wars. Let us, thought Doremus, not throb again to the bugles of the Civil War, nor find diverting the gallantry of Sherman's dashing Yankee boys in burning the houses of lone women, nor particularly admire the calmness of General Lee as he watched thousands writhe in the mud. He even wondered if, necessarily, it had been such a desirable thing for the 13 colonies to have cut themselves off from Great Britain. Had the United States remained in the British Empire, possibly there would have evolved a confederation that could have enforced world peace, instead of talking about it. Boys and girls from western ranches and southern plantations and northern maple groves might have added Oxford and York Minster and Devonshire villages to their own domain. Englishmen and even virtuous English women might have learned that persons who lacked the accent of a Kentish rectory or of a Yorkshire textile village may yet in many ways be literate, and that astonishing numbers of persons in the world cannot be persuaded that their chief aim in life ought to be to increase British exports on behalf of the stockholdings of the better classes. It is commonly asserted, Doremus remembered, that without complete political independence, the United States could not have developed its own peculiar virtues. Yet it was not apparent to him that America was any more individual than Canada or Australia, that Pittsburgh and Kansas City were to be preferred before Montreal and Melbourne, Sydney and Vancouver. No questioning of the eventual wisdom of the radicals who had first advocated these two American revolutions, Doremus warned himself, should be allowed to give any comfort to that eternal enemy, the conservative manipulators of privilege who damn as dangerous agitators any man who menaces their fortunes, who jump in their chairs at the sting of a gnat like Debs, and blandly swallow a camel like Windrip. Between the rabble-rousers, chiefly to be detected by desire for their own personal power and notoriety, and the unself-seeking fighters against tyranny, between William Walker or Danton and John Howard or William Lloyd Garrison, Doremus saw, there was the difference between a noisy gang of thieves and an honest man noisily defending himself against thieves. He had been brought up to revere the abolitionists, Lovejoy, Garrison, Wendell Phillips, Harriet Beecher Stowe, though his father had considered John Brown insane and a menace, and had thrown sly mud at the marble statues of Henry Ward Beecher, the apostle in the fancy vest. And Doremus could not do otherwise than revere the abolitionists now, though he wondered a little if Stephen Douglas and Thaddeus Stevens and Lincoln, more cautious and less romantic men, might not have done the job better. "Is it just possible," he sighed, "that the most vigorous and boldest idealists have been the worst enemies of human progress instead of its greatest creators? Possible that plain men with the humble trait of minding their own business will rank higher in the heavenly hierarchy than all the plumed souls who have shoved their way in among the masses and insisted on saving them?" Chapter 14. I joined the Christian, or as some call it, the Campbellite Church, as a mere boy, not yet dry behind the ears. But I wished then, and I wish now, that it were possible for me to belong to the whole glorious brotherhood, to be one in communion at the same time with the brave Presbyterians that fight the pusillanimous, mendacious, destructive, tomfool higher critics, so-called, and with the Methodists who so strongly oppose war yet in wartime can always be counted upon for patriotism to the limit, and with the splendidly tolerant Baptists, the earnest Seventh-day Adventists, and I guess I could even say a kind word for the Unitarians, as that great executive William Howard Taft belonged to them, also his wife. 0 hour. Berzelius Windrip. Officially, Doremus belonged to the Universalist Church, his wife and children to the Episcopal, a natural American transition. He had been reared to admire Hosea Ballou, the Universalist St. Augustine who, from his tiny parsonage in Barnard, Vermont, had proclaimed his faith that even the wickedest would have, after earthly death, another chance of salvation. But now Doremus could scarce enter the Fort Beulah Universalist Church. It had too many memories of his father, the pastor, and it was depressing to see how the old-time congregations, in which 200 thick beards would wag in the grained pine benches every Sunday morning, and their women folks and children line up beside the patriarchs, had dwindled to aged widows and farmers and a few school teachers. But in this time of seeking, Doremus did venture there. The church was a squat and gloomy building of granite, not particularly enlivened by the arches of colored slate above the windows. Yet as a boy, Doremus had thought it and its sawed-off tower the superior of Chartres. He had loved it as in Isaiah College he had loved the library, which, for all its appearance of being a crouching red-brick toad, had meant to him freedom for spiritual discovery. Still cavern of a reading room where for hours one could forget the world and never be nagged away to supper. He found, on his one attendance at the Universalist Church, a scattering of 30 disciples, being addressed by a supply, a theological student from Boston, monotonously shouting his well-meant, frightened, and slightly plagiaristic eloquence in regard to the sickness of Abijah, the son of Jeroboam. Doremus looked at the church walls, painted a hard and glistening green, unornamented, to avoid all the sinful trappings of papistry, while he listened to the preacher's hesitant droning.
Now, what so many of us fail to realize is how any sin that we ourselves may commit, any sin reflects not on ourselves, but on those that we hold near and dear.
He would have given anything, Doremus yearned, for a sermon which, however irrational, would passionately lift him to renewed courage, which would bathe him in consolation these beleaguered months. But with a shock of anger he saw that that was exactly what he had been condemning just a few days ago, the irrational dramatic power of the crusading leader, clerical or political. Very well, then, sadly. He'd just have to get along without the spiritual consolation of the church that he had known in college days. No, first he'd try the ritual of his friend, Dr. Falk, the Padre, Buck Titus sometimes called him. In the cozy Anglicanism of St. Crispin's P.E. Church, with its imitation English memorial brasses and imitation Celtic font, and brass eagle reading desk and dusty-smelling maroon carpet, Doremus listened to Mr. Falk.
Almighty God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who desireth not the death of a sinner, but rather that he may turn from his wickedness and live, and hath given power and commandment to his ministers to declare and pronounce to his people, being penitent, the absolution and remission of their sins.
Doremus glanced at the placidly pious facade of his wife, Emma. The lovely, familiar old ritual seemed meaningless to him now. with no more pertinence to a life menaced by Buzz Windrip and his Minutemen, no more comfort for having lost his old deep pride in being an American, than a stage revival of an equally lovely and familiar Elizabethan play. He looked about nervously. However exalted Mr. Falk himself might be, most of the congregation were Yorkshire pudding. The Anglican Church was to them not the aspiring humility of Newman, nor the humanity of Bishop Brown, both of whom left it, but the sign and proof of prosperity, an ecclesiastical version of owning a 12-cylinder Cadillac, or even more, of knowing that one's grandfather owned his own surrey and a respectable old family horse. The whole place smelled to Doremus of stale muffins. Mrs. R.C. Crowley was wearing white gloves, and on her bust, for a Mrs. Crowley, even in 1936, did not yet have breasts, was a tight bouquet of tuberoses. Francis Tasbrough had a morning coat and striped trousers, and on the lilac-colored pew cushion beside him was, unique in Fort Beulah, a silk top hat. And even the wife of Doremus's bosom, or at least of his breakfast coffee, the good Emma, had a pedantic expression of superior goodness, which irritated him. "Whole outfit stifles me," he snapped. "Rather be at a yelling, jumping, holy roller orgy. No, that's Buzz Windrip's kind of jungle hysterics. I want a church, if there can possibly be one, that's advanced beyond the jungle and beyond the chaplains of King Henry VIII. I know why, even though she's painfully conscientious, Lorinda never goes to church." Lorinda Pike, on that sleety December afternoon, was darning a tea-cloth in the lounge of her Beulah Valley Tavern, 5 miles up the river from the fort. It wasn't, of course, a tavern. It was a super boarding-house as regards its 12 guest bedrooms, and a slightly too arty tea room in its dining facilities. Despite his long affection for Lorinda, Doremus was always annoyed by the Singalese brass finger bowls, the North Carolina table mats, and the Italian ashtrays displayed for sale on wobbly card tables in the dining room. But he had to admit that the tea was excellent, the scones light, the Stiltons sound, Lorinda's private rum punches admirable, and that Lorinda herself was intelligent yet adorable, particularly when, as on this gray afternoon, she was bothered neither by other guests nor by the presence of that worm, her partner, Mr. Nipper, whose pleasing notion it was that because he had invested a few thousand in the tavern, he should have none of the work or responsibility and half the profits. Doremus thrust his way in, padding off the snow, puffing to recover from the shakiness caused by skidding all the way from Fort Beulah. Lorinda nodded carelessly, dropped another stick on the fireplace, and went back to her darning with nothing more intimate than, "Hello? Nasty out?"
"Yeah, fierce."
But as they sat on either side the hearth, their eyes had no need of smiling for a bridge between them. Lorinda reflected, "Well, my darling, it's going to be pretty bad. I guess Windrip and Company will put the woman's struggle right back in the 1600s, with Anne Hutchinson and the Antinomians."
"Sure, back to the kitchen.
Even if you haven't got one. Any worse than us men? Notice that Windrip never mentioned free speech and the freedom of the press in his articles of faith. Oh, he'd come out for 'em strong and hearty if he'd even thought of 'em."
"That's so. Tea, darling?"
"No. Linda, damn it, I feel like taking the family and sneaking off to Canada before I get nabbed. Right after Buzz's inauguration."
"No, you mustn't. We've got to keep all the newspaper men that'll go on fighting him and not go sniffling up to the garbage pail. Besides, what would I do without you?"
For the first time, Lorinda sounded importunate.
"You'll be a lot less suspect if I'm not around. But I guess you're right. I can't go till they put the skids under me. Then I'll have to vanish. I'm too old to stand jail."
"Not too old to make love, I hope. That would be hard on a girl." Nobody ever is, except the kind that used to be too young to make love. Anyway, I'll stay for a while. He had, suddenly, from Lorinda, the resoluteness he had sought in church. He would go on trying to sweep back the ocean just for his own satisfaction. It meant, however, that his hermitage in the ivory tower was closed with slightly ludicrous speed. But he felt strong again and happy. His brooding was interrupted by Lorinda's curt, "How's Emma taking the political situation?" "Doesn't know there is one. Here's me croaking, and she heard Walt Trowbridge's warning on the radio last evening. Did you listen in?" And she says, "Oh, my, how dreadful." And then forgets all about it and worries about the saucepan that got burnt. She's lucky. Oh, well, she probably calms me down and keeps me from becoming a complete neurote. Probably that's why I'm so darned everlastingly fond of her. And yet I'm chump enough to wish you and I were together. Recognizedly together all the time, and could fight together to keep some little light burning in this coming new glacial epoch. I do, all the time. I think that at this moment, all things considered, I should like to kiss you." "Is that so unusual a celebration?" "Yes, always. Always it's the first time again. Look, Linda, do you ever stop to think how curious it is that with everything between us, like that night in the hotel at Montreal, we neither one of us seem to feel any guilt, any embarrassment, can sit and gossip like this?" "No, dear, darling, it doesn't seem a bit curious. It was all so natural, so good." "And yet we're reasonably responsible people." "Of course. That's why nobody suspects us. Not even Emma. Thank God she doesn't, Doremus. I wouldn't hurt her for anything, not even for your kind-hearted favors." "Beast." "Oh, you might be suspected all by yourself. It's known that you sometimes drink liquor and play poker and tell hot ones. But who'd ever suspect that the local female crank, the suffragist, the pacifist, the anti-censorshipist, the friend of Jane Addams and Mother Bloor could be a libertine? Highbrows, bloodless reformers. Oh, and I've known so many women agitators, all dressed in Carrie Nation hatchets and modest sheets of statistics, that have been 10 times as passionate, intolerably passionate, as any cream-faced, plump little kept wife in chiffon step-ins." For a moment, their embracing eyes were not merely friendly and accustomed and careless. He fretted, "Oh, I think of you all the time and want you, and yet I think of Emma, too. And I don't even have the fine novelistic egotism of feeling guilty and intolerably caught in complexities." "Yes, it does all seem so natural, dear Linda." He stalked restlessly to the casement window, looking back at her every second step. It was dusk now, and the roads smoking. He stared out inattentively, then very attentively indeed. "That's curious, curiouser and curiouser. Standing back behind that big bush, lilac bush I guess it is, across the road, there's a fellow watching this place. I can see him in the headlights whenever a car comes along. And I think it's my hired man, Oscar Ledoux. Shad." He started to draw the cheerful red and white curtains. "No, no, don't draw them. He'll get suspicious." "That's right. Funny, his watching there. If it is him, he's supposed to be at my house right now, looking after the furnace. Winters, he only works for me a couple of hours a day. Works in the sash factory rest of the time, but he ought to. A little light blackmail, I suppose. Well, he can publish everything he saw today wherever he wants to." "Only what he saw today?" "Anything. Any day. I'm awfully proud. Old dishrag like me, 20 years older than you, to be your lover." And he was proud, yet all the while he was remembering the warning in red chalk that he had found on his front porch after the election. Before he had time to become very complicated about it, The door vociferously banged open, and his daughter Sissy sailed in.
"Watto, watto, watto. Toodaloo. Good morning, Jeeves. Morning, Miss Lindy. How's all the folks on the old plantation everywhere I roam? Hello, Dad. No, it isn't cocktails. At least, just one very small cocktail. It's youthful spirits. My God, but it's cold. Tea, Linda, my good woman, tea."
They had tea, a thoroughly domestic circle. "Race you home, Dad," said Sissy, when they were ready to go.
"Yes, no, wait a second. Lorinda, lend me a flashlight."
As he marched out of the door, marched belligerently across the road, Indoremus seethed all the agitated anger he had been concealing from Sissy. And part hidden behind bushes, leaning on his motorcycle, he did find Shad Ledoux. Shad was startled. For once he looked less contemptuously masterful than a Fifth Avenue traffic policeman, as Doremus snapped, "What you doing there?" And he stumbled in answering.
"Oh, I just... something happened to my motorbike."
"So, you ought to be home tending the furnace, Shad."
"Well, I guess I got my machine fixed now. I'll hike along."
"No, my daughter is to drive me home, so you can put your motorcycle in the back of my car and drive it back." Somehow he had to talk privately to Sissy, though he was not in the least certain what it was he had to say.
"Her? Rats. Sissy can't drive for sour apples. Crazy's a loon.
Ledoux, Miss Sissy is a highly competent driver. At least she satisfies me, and if you really feel she doesn't quite satisfy your standard..."
"Her drivin' don't make a damn bit of difference to me one way or the other. Good night."
Recrossing the road, Doremus rebuked himself. "That was childish of me, trying to talk to him like a gent. But how I would enjoy murdering him." He informed Sissy at the door.
"Shad happened to come along, motorcycle in bad shape. Let him take my Chrysler. I'll drive with you."
"Fine. Only 6 boys have had their hair turned gray driving with me this week.
And I meant to say, I think I'd better do the driving. It's pretty slippery tonight."
"Wouldn't that destroy you? Why, my dear idiot parent, I'm the best driver, and you can't drive for sour apples. Crazy, that's all. Get in, I'm driving, do you hear? Night, Lorinda."
"All right, dearest father," said Sissy with an impishness which reduced his knees to feebleness.
He assured himself, though, that this flip manner of Sissy, characteristic of even the provincial boys and girls who had been nursed on gasoline, was only an imitation of the nicer New York harlots, and would not last more than another year or two. Perhaps this rattle-tongued generation needed a Buzz Windrip revolution and all its pain.
"Beautiful, I know it's swell to drive carefully, but do you have to emulate the prudent snail?" said Sissy.
"Snails don't skid."
"No, they get run over. Rather skid."
"So your father's a fossil?"
"Oh, I wouldn't—"
"Well, maybe he is at that. There's advantages. Anyway, I wonder if there isn't a lot of bunk about age being so cautious and conservative, and youth always being so adventurous and bold and original. Look at the young Nazis and how they enjoy beating up the communists. Look at almost any college class. The students disapproving of the instructor because he's iconoclastic and ridicules the sacred hometown ideas. Just this afternoon I was thinking, driving out here..."
"Listen, Dad, do you go to Lindy's often?"
Why not especially? Why?"
"Why don't you... what are you two so scared of, you two wild-haired reformers? You and Lindy belong together. Why don't you, you know, kind of be lovers?"
"Good God Almighty, Cecilia. I've never heard a decent girl talk that way in all my life."
"Tst, tst, haven't you? Dear, dear, so sorry."
"Well, my Lord... at least you've got to admit that it's slightly unusual for an apparently loyal daughter to suggest her father's deceiving her mother, especially a fine, lovely mother like yours."
"Is it? Well, maybe. Unusual to suggest it. aloud. But I wonder if lots of young females don't sometimes kind of think it just the same when they see the venerable parent going stale.
Sissy!
Hey, watch that telephone pole!
Hang it, I didn't go anywheres near it. Now you look here, sissy. You simply must not be so froward, or forward, whichever it is. I always get those two words balled up. This is serious business. I've never heard of such a preposterous suggestion as Lorinda and I being lovers. My dear child, you simply can't be flip about such final things as that.
Oh, can't I? Oh, sorry, Dad. I just mean about Mother Emma. Of course I wouldn't have anybody hurt her, not even Lindy and you. But, why, bless you, venerable, she'd never even dream of such a thing. You could have your nice pie, and she'd never miss one single slice. Mother's mental grooves aren't, well, they aren't so very sex-conditioned, if that's how you say it. More sort of along the new vacuum cleaner complex, if you know what I mean. Paige Freud. Oh, she's swell, but not so analytical, and...
Are those your ethics, then?
Huh? Well, for cat's sake, why not? Have a swell time that'll get you full of beans again and yet not hurt anybody's feelings? Why, say, that's the entire second chapter in my book on ethics.
Sissy, have you by any chance any vaguest notion of what you're talking about, or think you're talking about? Of course, and perhaps we ought to be ashamed of our cowardly negligence, but I, and I don't suppose your mother, have taught you so very much about sex and...
Thank heaven. You spared me the dear little flower and its simply shocking affair with that tough tomcat of a tiger lily in the next bed. Excuse me. I mean in the next plot. I'm so glad you did. Pete's sake. I'd certainly hate to blush every time I looked at a garden.
Sissy, child, please, you mustn't be so beastly cute.
These are all weighty things. Penitently. I know, Dad. I'm sorry. It's just, if you only knew how wretched I feel when I see you so wretched and so quiet and everything. This horrible Windrip League of For God's Sakers business has got you down, hasn't it? If you're going to fight 'em, you've got to get some pep back into you. You've got to take off the lace mitts and put on the brass knuckles. And I got kind of a hunch Lorinda might do that for you, and only her. Eh, her pretending to be so high-minded. Remember that old wheeze Buck Titus used to love so? If you're saving the fallen women, save me one. Oh, not so good. I guess we'll take that line right out of the sketch. But anyway, our Lindy has a pretty moist and hungry eye.
Impossible, impossible. By the way, sissy, what do you know about all of this? Are you a virgin?
Dad, is that your idea of a question to... Oh, I guess I was asking for it. And the answer is yes, so far, but not promising one single thing about the future. Let me tell you right now, if conditions in this country do get as bad as you've been claiming they will, and Julian Falk is threatened with having to go to war or go to prison or some rotten thing like that, I'm most certainly not going to let any maidenly modesty interfere between me and him, and you might just as well be prepared for that.
It is Julian, then, not Malcolm.
Oh, I think so. Malcolm gives me a pain in the neck. He's getting all ready to take his proper place as a colonel or something with Windrip's wooden soldiers. And I am so fond of Julian, even if he is the doggondest, most impractical soul. Like his grandfather, or you. He's a sweet thing. We sat up purring pretty nothings till about 2 last night, I guess.
Sissy, but you haven't... Oh, my little girl. Julian is probably decent enough, not a bad sort, but you... You haven't let Julian take any familiarities with you.
Dear, quaint old word... As if anything could be so awfully much more familiar than a good, capable 10,000-horsepower kiss. But, darling, just so you won't worry, no. The few times late nights in our sitting room when I've slept with Julian, well, we've slept.
I'm glad, but your apparent, probably only apparent, information on a variety of delicate subjects slightly embarrasses me.
Now you listen to me, and this is something you ought to be telling me, not me you, Mr. Jessup. Looks as if this country and most of the world, I am being serious now, Dad, plenty serious, God help us all. It looks as if we're headed right back into barbarism. It's war. There's not going to be much time for coyness and modesty, any more than there is for a base hospital nurse when they bring in the wounded. Nice young ladies, they're out. It's Lorinda and me that you men are going to want to have around, isn't it? Isn't it? Now, isn't it?
Maybe, perhaps, Doremus sighed,
depressed at seeing a little more of his familiar world slide from under his feet as the flood rose. They were coming into the Jessup driveway. Shad Ledoux was just leaving the garage.
"Skip in the house quick, will you?" said Doremus to his girl.
"Sure, but do be careful, hun."
She no longer sounded like his little daughter, to be protected, adorned with pale blue ribbons, slyly laughed at when she tried to show off in grown-up ways. She was suddenly a dependable comrade like Lorinda. Doremus slipped resolutely out of his car and said calmly, "Shad?"
"Yup."
"Did you take the car keys into the kitchen?"
"Huh? No, I guess I left them in the car."
"I've told you 100 times they belong inside."
"Yeah? Well, how'd you like Miss Cecilia's drivin'? Have a good visit with old Mrs. Pike?"
He was derisive now, beyond concealment. "Ledoux, I rather think you're fired, right now."
"Well, just feature that."
"Okay, Chief. I was just going to tell you that we're forming a second chapter of the League of Forgotten Men in the fort. And I'm to be the secretary. They don't pay much, only about twice what you pay me, pretty tight-fisted. But it'll mean something in politics. Good night."
Afterward, Doremus was sorry to remember that for all his longshoreman clumsiness, Shad had learned a precise script in his red Vermont schoolhouse, and enough mastery of figures so that probably he would be able to keep this rather bogus secretaryship. Too bad. When, as League Secretary a fortnight later, Shad wrote to him demanding a donation of $200 to the League and Doremus refused, the informer began to lose circulation within 24 hours. Chapter 15.
"Usually I'm pretty mild. In fact, many of my friends are kind enough to call it folksy when I'm writin' or speechifying. My ambition is to live by the side of the road and be a friend to man. But I hope that none of the gentlemen who have honored me with their enmity think for one single moment that when I run into a gross enough public evil or a persistent enough detractor, I can't get up on my hind legs and make a sound like a two-tailed grizzly in April. So right at the start of this account of my 10-year fight with them as private citizen, state senator, and U.S. senator, let me say that the Sangfree River Light Power and Fuel Corporation are, and I invite a suit for libel, the meanest, lowest, cowardliest gang of yellow-livered, back-slapping, hypocritical gun-toters, bomb-throwers, ballot-stealers, ledger-fakers, givers of bribes, suborners of perjury, scab-hirers, and general low-down crooks, liars, and swindlers that ever tried to do an honest servant of the people out of an election. Not but what I have always succeeded in licking them, so that my indignation at these homicidal kleptomaniacs is not personal, but entirely on behalf of the general public."
0 hour, Berzelius Windrip. On Wednesday, January 6th, 1937, just a fortnight before his inauguration, President-elect Windrip announced his appointments of cabinet members and of diplomats. Secretary of State, his former secretary and press agent, Lee Saracen, who also took the position of High Marshal or Commander-in-Chief of the Minutemen, which organization was to be established permanently as an innocent marching club.
Secretary of the Treasury, one Webster R. Skittle, president of the prosperous Fur and Hide National Bank of St. Louis. Mr. Skittle had once been indicted on a charge of defrauding the government on his income tax, but he had been acquitted more